You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Elevator Constructors Local 12 and the Missouri AFL-CIO. Elevator Constructors Local 12 installs, repairs, modernizes, and maintains elevators and escalators in the western half of Missouri and the entire state of Kansas. The safety of the riding public is always our priority. And the Missouri AFL-CIO, bringing the voice of Missouri working families to the state capitol. The members of the Missouri AFL-CIO would like to remind you to register to vote. You have a voice, make it heard. We thank our underwriters for their support to KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum. On tonight's show, the European migrant crisis is all over the news. Journalist David Bacon will help us look into the crises behind the crisis, including war, imperialism, and poverty. Why are so many from Africa and the Middle East trying to break into Fortress Europe, and what should be done about it? In the news, a tribute to singer Ronnie Gilbert, dead at age 88, and St. Louis aldermen postpone minimum wage vote. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers. We'll talk with Mark Grunberg about what else? The fast-track debacle, of course. And now for the news.
This is the news from our side, June 25, 2015. As Kansas City considers raising its minimum wage to $15, an op-ed in the New York Times caught our attention. Most people don't know that five southern states have no minimum wage. They are Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee. In those states, if you're not covered by the federal minimum, then your employer can pay whatever they want. This is true for home care workers who care for the elderly and disabled people in their homes. The people who do this work are primarily women and people of color. The author of the article, Teresa Trich, called the lack of state minimum wage laws a vestige of slavery, just as surely as the persistence of Confederate flags in South Carolina and Alabama state capitals. She said it's time to change this as well.
St. Louis Public Radio reported that a committee of the Board of Aldermen postponed voting on legislation to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. The proposal to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 ran into tough opposition this week from the usual suspects, business groups like the St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce and the Missouri Restaurant Association. This despite endorsement by St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay and grassroots pressure from St. Louis Jobs with Justice. The ordinance's sponsor, Shane Cohn, agreed to lengthen the phase-in time to get to $15 from 2020 to 2024. This new proposal would raise the current minimum wage of $7.65 to $8.25, then would increase about 75 cents a year until it hits $15. Cohn also agreed to expand exemptions for a number of entities, including nonprofits and home health care companies. It would also tighten up language about franchises and continue to exempt businesses that have 15 or fewer employees or $500,000 or less in gross volume sales. Claiming that $15 would never pass, so he was doing proponents a favor, Alderman Joe Vaccaro introduced a proposal to raise the minimum to $10.10 by 2020.
PAI reports that Oregon is on the verge of becoming the fourth state to enact paid sick leave for most of its workers, with the measure headed for the desk of Democratic Governor Kate Brown. She's expected to sign it. When she does, Oregon firms with at least 10 workers, or at least 6 if they're in Portland, would have to offer 40 hours a year paid sick leave to full-time workers starting on January 1. Smaller firms would have to offer unpaid leave. Meanwhile, the county council in Montgomery County, Maryland, a large D.C. suburb, voted 9-0 for a county-paid sick leave ordinance. County Executive Ike Leggett plans to sign it. Oregon workers can use the leave for themselves or to care for family members, to attend doctor's appointments, and to treat illnesses and injuries. But it doesn't cover workers covered by a collective bargaining agreement who are employed through a hiring hall and whose benefits are provided by a union benefit trust. Oregon's paid sick leave law will take effect 2 years after Portland's paid leave ordinance kicked in. That law aids at least 250,000 workers. It guarantees them up to 40 hours of sick leave per year for all employees who work at least 240 hours a year in all firms with at least 6 workers. Smaller firms must grant unpaid leave.
Ronnie Gilbert died June 6th. She was an enormous singing and acting talent who gave her 88 years to work producing music for the people. In 1947, at age 19, she joined with Pete Seeger, Lee Hayes, and Fred Hellerman to form the Weavers, and they turned folk music into a popular genre, selling millions of records. Weavers' songs like Wimaway, Tsena Tsena Tsena, Guantanamera featured Ronnie's powerful contralto. The Weavers popularized songs by Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, like This Land Is Your Land and Goodnight Irene, and they sang on radio and TV and for unions and social movements. That is, until their progressive politics ran afoul of the McCarthy era and they were blacklisted in 1952. But they couldn't be silenced for long. In 1955, they made a comeback and performed at Carnegie Hall, making the Weavers at Carnegie Hall album that's a classic. The group continued with major bookings until it broke up in 1964. By then, they had influenced the revival of folk music with singers like the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Joan Baez. Ronnie went on to pursue a career as a solo singer, actor, and a psychologist. In 1983, singer Holly Near partnered with her for a series of concerts and several albums. Ronnie and Holly did a historic tour with Arlo Guthrie and Pete Seeger, which is preserved on Appleseed's H.A.R.P., A Time to Sing. Ronnie came to Kansas City a number of times. The last was in her one-woman show, Mother Jones, based on the life of the legendary American labor activist. Ronnie credited a concert she attended as a girl where she saw the great African-American singer Paul Robeson for showing her that music could be about something. She was a feminist, a global peace activist. Last year, she did a memorial concert for Pete Seeger. In the documentary, The Weavers Wasn't That a Time, Ronnie reminisced, "We sing union songs. We sang songs of hope in that strange time at the end of World War II when already the world was preparing for Cold War. We still had the feeling that if we could sing loud enough and strong enough and hopefully enough, it would make a difference." The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Ariana Eagle, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel, and we'll go out with a song from an album Ronnie made of Civil War songs called Lincoln and Liberty. It reminds us of something Ronnie knew, that the struggle for freedom is long and takes a lot of us singing strongly to make a difference.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too. Then up with the banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. We'll fight till our banner's victorious, for Lincoln and liberty too. All you true friends of the nation, attend to humanity's call. Come aid in the
the slave's liberation, and roll on the Liberty Ball. And roll on the Liberty Ball, and roll on the Liberty Ball. Call in the slave's liberation, and roll on the Liberty Ball. We'll finish the temple of freedom and make it capacious within, that all who seek shelter may find it, whatever the hue of their skin. Whatever the hue of their skin, whatever the hue of their skin, that all who seek shelter may find it, whatever the hue of their skin. Success to the old-fashioned doctrine that men are created all free, and down with the power of the despot, wherever his stronghold may be. Wherever his stronghold may be, wherever his stronghold may be, and down with the power of the despot, wherever his stronghold may be.
On June 8th, journalist David Bacon wrote an article about the migrant crisis in Europe. It began, "Every day people launch themselves in rickety boats into the Mediterranean, hoping to navigate the perilous passage to Europe, hundreds drowning in the attempt. In the last weekend of May alone, European naval and merchant ships rescued more than 5,000 migrants after boats issued a distress call, according to the European Union Border Control Agency, Frontex. The death toll is on the rise. At least 1,770 people have died so far this year. The International Organization for Migration warns that the migrant death toll could reach 30,000 in 2015. David Bacon is a former union organizer, a radio programmer on KPFA in Berkeley, California, and the all-round expert on Mexican migrants and migration to the U.S. His most recent book is The Right to Stay Home. I'm Judy Ansel, and with me is Jake White. Welcome to the show, David.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Judy.
So, you called your article, "Enforcement is Not the Answer to Europe's Migrant Crisis." What's been the European reaction to the surge of migrants coming across the Mediterranean?
Well, in terms of the official reaction to it, the European countries, especially the big economies, and here we're talking about the UK, France, Italy, Germany, and the EU itself, went to the Security Council of the UN at the beginning of May and got the UN or insisted on a discussion of their plan to use their navies, the EU navies, to intercept boats carrying migrants as they cross the Mediterranean, to forcibly take the people on those boats on board ships, then take them back to where they aborted, which is usually Libya, to basically force them back ashore in Libya, and then to destroy the boats, to burn the boats. And there was also in the discussion along with that some discussion of actually military action in Libya itself against what they're calling the smugglers. So the official reaction has been to demonize the smugglers. In other words, the people who are setting up these ocean voyages for people who are trying to make it from North Africa into Europe. And so, you know, there's a lot of heated rhetoric coming from everybody from François Hollande, the Prime Minister of France, to Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, in which they're calling them the pirates of the 21st century and so forth and so on, as though the people who were operating the boats and what they're calling the smugglers are themselves the source of the migration or the real problem in terms of migration. So this has been, and this is why I called the article, you know, "The Enforcement is Not the Answer," because this is an enforcement measure. It's sort of very reminiscent, I think, of what the U.S. approach has been towards people coming across the border between the U.S. and Mexico, or for that matter, what we've seen the Australian government doing in terms of people coming from South and Southeast Asian countries trying to get into Australia and New Zealand.
So, David, people fleeing across borders is a worldwide problem. People, you know, escaping dangerous situations. Europe is getting headlines now, but people are dying and suffering crossing borders in many places and on many seas. So, you mentioned Australia, and where else besides Europe and the U.S. are there massive numbers of migrants coming across and running into dangerous situations?
Well, the three big migrant flows in the world today, and these things, you know, change from decade to decade, but right now the main big flows are coming from Mexico and Central America into the U.S. across the Mexican border, with a significant number of people also coming from Caribbean countries and coming by other means from, you know, Pacific Rim countries, and even now African immigrants coming into the United States, although they don't come by either boat or by walking, but usually, you know, come on airplanes. But we can, you know, talk about that a little bit later. The second flow of people is coming into Europe, who are mostly coming across the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy. It used to be that one of the main migration routes was into Europe across the Strait of Gibraltar from Ceuta and Melilla in the Spanish enclaves in Morocco into Gibraltar and then into Spain. That's been pretty much closed off now. It's sort of like going to the border of Tijuana. There's such massive enforcement there that it's really almost impossible to get across. But now there's also a significant number of people coming into Greece, for instance, from the Middle East directly. And then the last big flow of migrants consists of migrants who are leaving countries like Bangladesh, Myanmar, Malaysia, even Indonesia itself, going to Australia and to New Zealand, although some of those folks are going from, for instance, Myanmar and Bangladesh into Malaysia itself. So Malaysia and Indonesia, for instance, are countries which are, on the one hand, receiving migrants who are leaving countries where people are even worse off. And on the other hand, they are countries that themselves are the source of rather enormous amounts of migration, actually, to Australia, New Zealand, and of course, lots of people are coming here to the United States as well, too.
The UN, I think, says that there are something like 215 or 225 million people in the world who are working outside of their country of birth. And so we know migration is a worldwide phenomenon. But why are so many coming out of Africa now and out of the Middle East? You call it blowback in your article.
Well, you know, Judy, in the mainstream press, the image that we're being presented of people coming from Africa and the Middle East is the people who are fleeing wars. And there is a distinction that is being made between people who are fleeing wars or political repression, but mostly wars, who are being called refugees or political refugees, and people who are coming primarily for economic reasons, as, for instance, people coming from Mexico to the United States. In reality, though, these two sources of migration are very, very hard to tell apart, in part because the reason for many of the wars that we have in the world have to do with the legacy of colonialism, the legacy of imperialism, the legacy of this huge, huge economic inequality in the world between the rich industrial countries of the United States, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and those countries that were formerly their colonies, which have now achieved political independence, but are still living with the impact of, in some cases, centuries of underdevelopment as a result of this sort of colonial structure. So the wars, in many cases, we could think, for instance, about the wars in Central America, which I think most listeners are probably more familiar with than the wars in Africa. The wars in Central America were wars in which people were trying to overcome this history of being, in essence, you know, the sort of pseudo-colonies of the United States, coming from countries, countries which were extremely unequal, in which the wealth was held by a very, very tiny portion of the people, and most people were extremely poor. When people tried to change that social structure, they then faced not only their own elites, which, you know, turned their armies against them, and therefore we had civil wars in countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, but also the U.S. would come in on the side of those elites, essentially trying to maintain them in power. So we had the Reagan administration, for instance, giving enormous amounts of arms to the dictatorship of Guatemala, which then used them to massacre tens of thousands of people, mostly indigenous people in the countryside in Guatemala, in order to prevent any kind of social change. To a large degree, this is also the source of the conflict that we have seen in Africa, for instance, where people are trying to change their social structure and are prevented from doing so, in large part by, you know, governments that have, you know, using their arms against them. And we have countries like France, for instance, which are now openly intervening militarily in countries to basically try and maintain a situation which is one that European countries essentially approve of. So, you know, these are conflicts that all have a very, very long history. And so when people come from a country like Mali or a country like Uganda, for instance, I think it's very legitimate to ask, are these people simply fleeing a war or fleeing political repression, or are they fleeing the poverty and the growth, economic inequality, which is a consequence of, you know, 200 years of colonialism and, an economic situation which was for the enormous benefit of Europe and for the enormous disadvantage of the people living in Africa.
So can we talk some more about the structures and the institutions that cause that? One example being the EU-East African Economic Partnership Agreement and IMF and World Bank structural adjustment programs and austerity programs. And can you just talk about how some of those larger institutional arrangements work and how they push people on the bottom to have to move to a different country?
Sure. Well, the EU-East Africa Partnership Agreement is kind of like, you could sort of think of it as being their version of NAFTA, because what this partnership consists of is an arrangement under which European corporations are able to open the markets in countries like Kenya or Somalia or Burundi or Uganda, and operate in those countries without any restriction. Now, one of the things that might take place, for instance, is the dumping of goods on those markets and driving native producers out of business. You know, they used to say that, for instance, in Mexico and in Central America, you couldn't find a single company that could make toothpaste because they had all been driven out of business by the dumping of products, you know, from the U.S. Well, the same thing is happening in East Africa with the dumping of products from Europe. So on the one hand, you have these countries, basically their economies being transformed for the benefit of European corporations that want the markets, and of course they also want access to the raw materials and the resources of those countries, and the ability to invest, for instance, in the privatized healthcare system or in other privatized resource extraction enterprises like mines, for instance. All of this for the benefit, essentially, big European capital and not for the benefit of those countries. Well, what happens as a result of that is people get displaced when, for instance, the small business that they're working for goes out of business. They lose their jobs, or if they're farmers in the countryside, they can't produce, they can't compete with produce being dumped from Europe. all of these things cause people to leave home and to begin looking for some way of surviving. In other words, people begin to migrate. And, of course, people go where the jobs and the money is, which is in Europe itself. And, of course, in many ways, people are going from countries that were formerly the colonies of Europe back to Europe, which was the colonizing country. So these relationships didn't just begin with this partnership agreement. These relationships go back, you know, several hundred years. At the same time, in order to make the economies of developing countries more investor-friendly or more corporate-friendly, institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund implement conditions or impose conditions on those countries in return for bank loans. This is exactly what we're seeing in Greece, for instance, today, that the conditions for loans are sometimes extremely disadvantageous, especially to the working people of those countries, where the IMF or the World Bank will demand cuts in the social budget, whether it's for pensions or for health care or for education. And at the same time, they want reform in countries' labor laws, making it, for instance, harder for people to go on strike or maintaining a low level of wages or a low minimum wage level in those countries. So these also then become reasons why people have to leave home in order to survive. In other words, poverty. These measures increase poverty at the expense of those people who benefit from the payment of the loans. And you think about, well, who is it then that loans money to the government of Burundi? Who is it that loans money to the government of Nigeria? And what use gets made of that money? And of course, the loans come from European and U.S. banks. So this is in order to ensure that bankers get repaid the money that they lend. And the money that is lent goes overwhelmingly to make those countries ones in which it's easy for corporations to make profits. So in the case of Nigeria, for instance, that means making sure that the infrastructure that large oil companies need in order to extract Nigerian oil gets maintained, even if the educational system of Nigeria is falling apart. So these bank loans aren't ones that are used for the benefit of ordinary working people. They're loans that are used essentially for maintaining an infrastructure that also allows for corporate profit making. So it's really a corporate dominated structure here. What we're doing is we are seeing all of these international partnerships and agreements and austerity programs put in place so that private corporations and banks make money. But the price of making that money is paid by working people, either in the form of increased poverty and fewer social services, but more and more and more in the case of people who really have no alternative but to leave home and to look for work elsewhere if they want to survive, which is the reason why we're seeing this big increase in migration around the world at the same time as we see the increasing implementation of these trade agreements, these partnership agreements, and these austerity programs.
Just wait till the Trans-Pacific Partnership gets kicked in, right?
You bet. That's exactly what's going to happen there, too.
We're talking to David Bacon, a journalist who has written an article about the surge of migrants going into Europe. And speaking of Europe, David, when these migrants arrive, what rights do they have? And I know there's international conventions that supposedly guarantee the rights of migrants, but they make a distinction also between people seeking asylum and people who are mere economic refugees. How's Europe handling this?
Well, the number of people who applied for asylum alone last year in the EU was about 600,000 people.
Wow.
So the number of people is really enormous. And there are hundreds of thousands of people in addition to that who are coming into Europe who cannot or do not make application for asylum and simply live there as undocumented people. So really the number of migrants coming into Europe is very high. So the response of Europe to this kind of migration is, well, of two kinds. First of all, to restrict the approval of asylum applications. Now, the 600,000 people who applied for asylum last year, that doesn't mean that 600,000 people get asylum. That just means that 600,000 people applied for it. And, of course, this is not evenly distributed through Europe, so there's a lot of complaint from countries which are the host to the largest number of these applicants, which would be, for instance, Germany and Italy in particular, saying that, you know, other countries are not doing their share to absorb, you know, the large number of migrants coming into Europe. But also, Europe is passing laws which criminalize the migration of people who do not have any legal status. So Italy, for instance, at the end of the 90s, started passing laws which together are kind of known as the Bossi-Fini law, which essentially criminalizes undocumented status in Italy. It's a law that looks very much like the kind of laws we have in the United States. And the impact of it, of course, is very much the same. You know, the number of people who are being held in detention, for instance, in Europe is rising just as it is here in the U.S. So the response of Europe is to criminalize undocumented migration and to restrict the amount of legal migration that European countries are willing to permit. So you can think of the people who are receiving refugee status. The United States is not a big receiver of refugees. In fact, countries all over the world complain that the United States does more than its share of starting the wars that cause a lot of refugees and does very little at absorbing them. You know, the United States absorbed very, very few people from Iraq after the Iraq War. Here we are very involved in the war in Syria. The United States has received practically no people who are refugees from the Syrian war, who are overwhelmingly going to the countries that are, you know, just in the immediate geographical neighborhood. But so the people who have legal status in the United States are mostly people who have visas of one kind or another, especially from their resident status, the so-called green card. So here in the U.S. we have an immigrant population that is divided between visa holders and undocumented people. In Europe, the immigrant population is divided between primarily those people who have gotten refugee status and those people who are undocumented. And then the legal response is pretty much the same as what you've seen here, which is to restrict the number of people who get legal status and at the same time criminalize and use increasingly heavy means of enforcement against those people who don't have any legal status at all.
David, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to ask you a few more questions.
On the next Wings.
I think what's most scary about huge media companies is that they essentially become larger than the public.
How does media concentration harm us, and where does the struggle against it stand today? Saturday at 2:30 p.m.
He was listening to voices talking in his head. If you grew up in America, you know exactly what they said. And with every job we lose, however bad things get, there's a black man in the White House on the TV set. And we can blame it all on him and his entire race, because they no longer know their place. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the State House lawn. He was listening to voices. You could say that he was crazy for thinking certain people are just born to be lazy. He could see it on the cop shows. They don't know right from wrong. The race war is coming, and now it won't be long. I promise it was not his original notion. If you want to start a war, first you have to set the war in motion. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. He was listening to voices who said the conflict's coming soon. And he walked into the church on the 17th of June, on the very date of the rebellion that never was to be, for which 35 were hanged in that very city, for which the church was burned, for which the church was banned, for which there's been no atonement in a sick and troubled land. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn.
And that was David Rovics with his new song, On the State House Lawn.
We're now back with journalist David Bacon, who on June 8th published an article in Al Jazeera titled Enforcement is Not the Answer to Europe's Migrant Crisis. David, in America we've seen a lot of social consequences from immigration across our borders, and we've seen calls to close the borders and things like that. But in the context of European countries, I think two of the main social consequences that we've seen over immigration are like Islamophobia and anti-black racism. And I was wondering, just because most of the refugees are coming from the Middle East or from Africa, and I was wondering, are we seeing an increase over that? And is that playing out in electoral politics in Europe at all?
Well, yes, there is an increase in Islamophobia. There is an increase in anti-immigrant sentiment. When people in Europe talk about anti-black sentiment, what they're talking about is anti-sentiment against people of color in generally, because the word black in Europe and many European countries is used to refer to people of color, not necessarily just people of African heritage, but of people, you know, even people from Asia or people from the Middle East. But yes, we're seeing a great deal of increase in that, which in part is the result of the manipulation of people who have become very unhappy and very fearful as a result of the economic crisis in Europe and the result of the imposition of austerity programs. You know, this is, you know, it's no accident, for instance, that the New Dawn Party in Greece was an extremely small party until the Greek crisis, economic crisis, began, at which point it began to grow quite rapidly. And the same thing has happened in Britain. The anti-immigrant party just won an election in Denmark. We've seen this all over Europe. But it's not just sort of a spontaneous growth. And in some ways, I don't think it even has that much to do with an increase in the levels of migration. What it has to do with is an increase in the level of insecurity of working people in Europe who are, in some cases, the victims of very extreme austerity programs, as in Greece, or the victims of very high rates of unemployment as a result of this unemployment, as a result of the economic crisis, as we've seen in countries like Spain, Portugal, and even in France and some of the northern European countries. So, you know, European politicians, especially on the right, rather than making proposals for the an end to not just the economic crisis, but to those measures which have forced working people to pay the cost of it, it's much more convenient for them to essentially scapegoat and say, well, the reason why, you know, European working people are having problems is because of too many people coming in from outside. You know, it's very, very similar to the kinds of arguments you hear on the anti-immigrant right in the United States. So, you know, that's sort of like the political response of part of Europe. But I think it's also important to say that this is not a majority sentiment in Europe by any means. And in fact, there are many political parties and political groupings of people in Europe who have come to the defense of immigrants. There's a very famous one in France, for instance, called SOS Racisme, which is an anti-racist organization which has been in France for quite a long time, which objected to the government's proposals, for instance, trying to ban women from wearing headscarves, which was basically a very anti-Islamic and proposal by the government that was really kind of like a concession to this kind of Islamophobia. So in Greece, for instance, the people who were in opposition to the New Dawn Party were a much larger section of the Greek population than the New Dawn Party itself was able to attract. So I think that the left in Europe especially has had some very rational responses to the questions that are being posed by migration and the deaths of people in the ocean, and at the same time have stood very strongly against the demonization of migrants themselves.
Yeah, well, let's hope they don't go through the same crazy paralysis that has occurred here in our politics over immigration reform. So, you know, David, you talk about two different rights. You talk about the right to migrate and the rights of migrants, but you also talk about the right to stay home. In fact, you wrote a whole book about it. What's it going to take to actually protect the right of people to stay home?
Change. It's going to take political and economic change, both inside the countries that people are coming from, but changing the relationship between those countries and the countries that people are going to. So concretely, what this means is for people to be able to stay in a country like Mexico, for instance, people need, in rural Mexico, they need health care, they need good schools, they need a politically democratic system in which they have a voice. People need jobs. People need high prices for agricultural products. All of those things give people the ability to choose whether they want to migrate or not. In other words, migration does not then become a question that you either leave home or your family doesn't survive. You can choose one or the other because there is actually a decent life and a decent future for you if you choose to stay home. And this is really the same set of choices that confront people in countries all over the world where people are migrating in search of a decent life. So whether it's somebody who's living in the Niger Delta in Nigeria who need freedom from the kind of pollution that's being caused by Shell and Standard and these oil companies that have wrecked the environment of the Niger Delta in an effort to extract the oil, people need that, and they also need the Nigerian government to take the money that they've gotten from the oil and use it for the to basically give people a better life in the towns that people are currently having to migrate from. So that's a good example of the fact that you need change that, on the one hand, is the responsibility of the government of those countries, but you also need the corporations and the trade agreements and the structural adjustment policies, the austerity policies that are coming from countries like the United States or the wealthy countries from Eastern Europe, those have to be changed as well, too, because those policies are, in some cases, creating and at the very least reinforcing the poverty that people are already trying to leave behind them. So the right to stay home means change. The right to stay home means political change. It means economic change in the communities that you come from. Now, this does not mean that people who are leaving home, whether it's in Nigeria or Mexico, think that migration is evil or wrong, or that people who are doing this are committing some kind of a crime. Actually, people, I think, have a great deal of admiration often for those people who are willing to leave home in order to get to Europe, in order to get to the United States so that they can send money back home and help their families to survive. So the right to stay home is also part of a larger set of rights that includes the rights of people who migrate as well. Very often in the political discourse that you hear in Mexico, in places like Oaxaca, for instance, where people talk about the right to stay home a lot, they also talk about the right of migrants, the right to work, the right to a decent pay where you work, the right to organize a union, the right to be free from the threat of deportation. All of these things are important rights, not just to those people who directly need them, in other words, the migrants themselves, but these are also important rights for the communities that people are leaving behind, because when people are able to migrate and have a full set of rights and have some degree of social and economic and political equality in the countries where they're going to, this means that their ability to help their families at home is increased. It's really something that benefits people at home. So the people at home, so to speak, need, on the one hand, they need direct improvements in their situation, which is the right to stay home, political change, but they also need that they need for the people who are doing the migrating to have rights as well, too. That's why you really can't separate these two rights, the right to stay home, but also the right of migrants to political and economic and social equality in the countries that people are going to. These rights are sort of very, very intimately connected with each other.
Gee, do you think that's possible under our current system of global capitalism?
Well, perhaps not completely. I think that capitalism as a system is not really capable, in the end, of providing a means for the vast bulk of the world's people to have economic and social development and democracy that's in our own interests. I think we really have to have some very profound change in order to get that. But I think that it is possible to have a much fairer and better system than the one we have now, even under capitalism. I think our capitalist system in the United States is capable of at least affording some basic rights to migrants here. And I think we can also work without even envisioning a future of socialism or some more profound change like that. We can defeat trade agreements. We can defeat things like austerity programs and structural adjustment policies and sort of put a straitjacket on corporations and banks that prevent them from doing what they're doing right now, which is acting like international predators in the countries in which they operate. So I think that it's possible. We didn't win this last vote on TPP, but I think that it is within our capability as people in this country, for instance, to stop this procession of trade agreements. In fact, not just to stop it, but to reverse course. You know, Mike Michaud, who was the Congress member from Maine, proposed in Congress a trade act, which had as one of its provisions that we would hold hearings about the impact of NAFTA on us here in this country, which I think could easily be extended to say, let's look at the impact of NAFTA on Mexico as well, too, so that we can see that working people in both countries suffered as a result of it. But what is the logical consequence of holding hearings like that if it's not to actually change the agreement or get rid of the agreement that we have and work towards a much better and more just relationship between the U.S. and Mexico? And that is possible under capitalism, I believe.
Well, thank you for your optimism, David Bacon, and thanks for the interview. I also want to thank Jake White for co-hosting with me.
It was my pleasure to be with you. Take care.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and with me on the phone is Mark Grunberg with this month's Washington Window on Workers. You there, Mark?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening. So I take it you paid close attention to the fast-track votes?
Right. We finally come to the end of this saga.
Yeah, well,
let me briefly recap. The Senate and the House have both passed fast-track as a standalone bill. Sent it to the president. The Senate passed aid to workers who lose their jobs to trade as a and attached it to an uncontroversial trade bill dealing with Africa. Sent that to the House. The House passed it. That goes to the president. And those are the two key pieces in the whole thing.
Okay, so
there's a third one, but
fast track passed by one vote, right?
Fast track itself actually passed by. It passed by the second time around. It passed by five votes in the House, 218 to 208.
I guess it was the cloture vote
down the middle.
It was the cloture vote.
Senate, it passed by a wider margin. There were the question is whether they were going to debate it at all, and that's where it was down to only 60 votes, and that's all they needed to debate it. So.
Yeah, I guess I was asking you about the cloture vote, which they had 60 votes, and that was like if they'd had one less vote, it would have failed. That was to cut off debate. So we're figuring here in Missouri that that vote was Claire McCaskill's vote. What do you think about that?
Claire McCaskill was one of those who flipped the first time around, and so it could be her. Or it could be one of about three or four other flippers. Another one would be Chris Coons of Delaware, but don't be surprised if it is McCaskill. After all, she's not up next year, so she could, sort of do it. Whereas Blunt is up,
Mark. Okay, you still there, Mark?
I'm still here.
Yeah, same well, be glad you're there and not here.
We get the same alerts. So
anyway, let me ask you one more question: the trade adjustment assistance bill was this the watered down trade adjustment assistance bill that passed, or was it one that is also going to include secondary workers who lose their jobs because of trade?
This is the watered down trade adjustment assistance bill. Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, tried to expand it back when this whole debate started, and he went down, and that went down the drain. The Republicans basically voted against expanding trade adjustment assistance, and of course they had to twist arms in the House to get their people to even vote for it at all this afternoon. So
wow.
Even the watered down version.
Well, I think there's a lot of conclusions people can draw from this about who Congress actually represents, but it's pretty clear that working people lost on this round.
Right.
Hopefully you'll have better news next month.
Oh, we put it in our lead. This is a win for the corporations and the 1%.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Mark. We'll talk to you next month.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Cross Border Network First Friday fundraiser to support Honduras solidarity work. Friday, July 3rd, 6 to 9 p.m. at Volpe's Bastille Gallery at 1737 Locust, KCMO.
Patriots Picnic. Celebrate the 4th of July and support the American Friends Service Committee. Saturday, July 4th, 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. 8336 Sagamore, Leawood, Kansas, 66206.
And We Can Do It, Stories of Rosie the Riveter, a new film about the World War II era Kansas City defense workers, July 11th, 11 a.m. Harry Truman Library, 500 West U.S. Highway 24, Independence, Missouri. All local Rosies are invited to share their stories.
The Midwest School for Women Workers, July 19th through the 23rd, DePaul and Roosevelt Universities, Chicago. For a brochure and registration, go to MidwestWomenWorkers.org.
And the UAW Local 31 Jim Wells Memorial Golf Tournament, Saturday, August 1st, Sunflower Hills Golf Course, Kansas City, Kansas. To register a team, call the union at 913-342-7330. And check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on www.heartlandlaborforum.org.
And that's it. That's it for the show. Tune in next week. The show is called Y-15, the Kansas City Minimum Wage Increase. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.